couch of potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Countdown, Black and Blue, and The Lighthouse, plus a look at The Laundromat from Netflix and Lucy in the Sky, which is out in limited release right now. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Lion King. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to talk about involves Joker, and it's not necessarily about Joaquin Phoenix's version of the Joker. It's actually about Jared Leto, who, if you remember, he did the Suicide Squad movie, or rather, he did Suicide Squad. The Suicide Squad is the reboot done by James Gunn, which is not going to have the Joker in it because nobody wants the Jared Leto version of the Joker because that was hot garbage, just as Suicide Squad as a movie was hot garbage. But apparently Jared Leto pitched a fit when he found out that they were doing Todd Phillips' version of Joker. I get this to a degree because it was a part that was handed to him kind of as a, hey, you're going to be the new Joker and you're going to be around for a while. Because they were not making him the main villain, he wasn't going to get killed off at the end, which of course is what happened in Batman in 1989, and of course that happened with The Dark Knight. I think Leto felt that he was going to have a nice run as the Joker, at least as long as Ben Affleck was going to be Batman, and we see how that worked out. Apparently, he went as far as to complain to his agent, who tried to get the movie ultimately stopped, and I imagine that there's a certain degree of ability that he had for that, because I'm sure there are contracts here and there between himself and Warner Brothers, and he probably was contracted for a certain number of movies, and because they never continued his character, he didn't get to do any more. And I think he wanted to do more, but I don't really necessarily even blame Leto as much as I blame David Ayers, who was in charge of Suicide Squad and made such a god-awfully terrible movie and did such a terrible version of the Joker. And I was reading this article online on, I think it was on ScreenRant.com, and it was saying, oh, well, you know, even though people liked his version of the Joker, no, they didn't. I mean, some people did, sure, but, you know, some people like liver and onions, but that doesn't mean that it's something good. His version of the Joker was resoundingly rejected by a lot of people. In fact, when you're upstaged by Harley Quinn, who everybody in that movie was, it shows that that's not the reason people wanted to see that movie. Jared Leto's version of the Joker was the most basal, trying to be a streetwise element with the tats and the grill. He was not a good version of the Joker. And I can't imagine developing that Joker anymore. It had the depth of a Transformers movie. Whereas if you look at some of the better versions of the Joker, like look at Heath Ledger, there was a lot in there. And of course, Joaquin Phoenix did a lot with that. Could you imagine if they did the Jared Leto version of the Joker for the movie Joker? That would have been awful. His character, everything was up front. It was like, I have deranged tattooed on my forehead, therefore I must be insane. It was awful. So it's a good thing that Jared Leto didn't get his way. The next piece of news I want to hit is about Avatar and its sequels. I know we've been hearing about this for literally 10 years. We've been hearing about Avatar, and eventually we're going to have sequels. And what's the thing where he says, by 2024 or 2026, how many presidents are we going to go through before we get to the next Avatar sequel? I mean, you usually think that you have a sequel come out just a couple years later, but this has been 10 years. This December is the 10th anniversary of the release of Avatar, and they're still working on the sequels. Now it's come out that James Cameron has said that he's not going to shoot them in a high frame rate, which I found fascinating because I recall a couple years ago, he was planning on shooting them in a high frame rate. He was like, I'm not even going to shoot them at 60 frames a second, which is what the Hobbit movie was shot with. He's like, I'm going to shoot it at 120 frames a second. Well, we had that with Gemini Man a couple weeks ago, and that thing flopped. Nobody cared about that movie, and nobody was wowed, except for the real geeky cinemaphiles. No one was really wowed about it. It had nothing to do with technology. It had to do with the fact that the story was kind of lame. And that's why nobody went to go see Gemini Man. But I did read a part where Cameron does get it right, as he says there are certain times when the frame rate works, like high action and low light situation. But he says when you have a scene in a kitchen with two people talking, it just looks like you're on set with two people with makeup. And that's exactly why high frame rate doesn't work. And when you watch Gemini Man, oh, the action sequences are cool and the underwater sequences are cool. But when Will Smith's standing there talking in a shack to Mary Elizabeth Winstead, it looks bad. And like the shots of Clive Owen as the bad guy in the room with his other cohort, it just looked cheesy. And it's those walk and talk scenes or those low action scenes that are going to be a problem. And I think Cameron swerves into a point where maybe the future of cinema is not to always use a high frame rate. And I said this back when the Hobbit movie came out. The scene where they're going through Goblin Town looked great in the high frame rate. When all the dwarfs were sitting around the table in Bilbo Baggins' place, it looked terrible. So maybe the idea is on these necessary scenes, you can ramp it up. It'd be nice to have ramping technology on this stuff that it'll go from 30 frames a second up to 60 or 120, depending on what action's going on screen. That may be the future, but still, that's a lot more nuanced than just playing one movie on a single frame rate. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is Uncut Gems, which opens on December 13th.
What is that?
I started it.
Are you serious?
You're taking my money all over town, placing bets.
I'm having very serious second thoughts.
Are you serious right now?
Is it too late?
Howard, where's the money right now?
Howard, got my money?
Howard!
What do you think? I'm done. It meant nothing. Please. Give me another shot.
You think I'm stupid, Howard? You and your whole family!
Now, this is being heralded as the chance for Adam Sandler to redeem himself, because he's done all those movies like Grown Ups and Jack and Jill. This reminds me of the praise you're getting Adam Sandler for a movie like, if you remember, Punch Drunk Love when that came out. And he's tried to do these dramas before. He tried to do that with Spanglish years ago. He tried to do that with Rain Over Me. He's done his fair share of serious movies that are essentially trying to be a launching point for a more serious acting career. And I think he has the chops to do it. Will this movie be the one? I don't know. This is a movie that it's going to get a lot of buzz, but nobody's going to see it. I think anybody's going to care about it. It's by the Safdie brothers. And their last movie they did was Good Time. And that one starred Robert Pattinson. But it was a movie that got him a lot of praise, and a lot of people in the critical community liked it, but it just kind of didn't do a whole lot. So I think this is going to give a certain amount of credibility back to Adam Sandler, but I don't think it's going to redeem him necessarily outside of his Netflix romp with other movies that the mainstream audience is going to see. The next one I want to hit is Peter Rabbit 2, The Runaway, which opens on April 3rd.
Are you the author?
It's really the rabbit story. I just wrote it down.
Look, Dad. It's Peter Rabbit. He's a little naughty.
What?
Are you Peter?
That depends who's asking.
Stay out of trouble.
Told you he has it in for me.
He was talking to all of us.
I'm talking to you, Peter. Specifically, stay out of trouble. Trouble. Trouble.
If that's who they think I am, maybe I'd be better off without them.
Look, the first Peter Rabbit was kind of a mess anyways. I mean, it would strayed so far from the heart of what the Beatrix Potter stories were and just turned it into like a Marmaduke movie or a Garfield movie. And that wasn't very good, but it looks like we're getting more of the same. Oh yeah, James Corden as the whimsical rabbit, and you know, Rose Byrne's adorable, but it looks like these talking animal movies sometimes just go so basal and they lose the charm of what it was. It reminds me a little bit of that Mr. Popper's Penguins they made. And when you actually read the original Mr. Popper's Penguins book, it's charming and sweet and cute. And then they had a bird pooping on Jim Carrey for 2 hours. And that's kind of what I have a feeling Peter Rabbit 2 is going to end up being without the penguin poop. It'll just be rabbit poop. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Countdown and The Laundromat. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with a movie I haven't seen. Actually, I'm not going to give this one a preemptive suck. I'm just going to say that I wasn't able to see it due to scheduling situations this week. I had to travel for something. I'll talk more about that next week. But they did screen this like last minute. Countdown is a film in which a group of friends are terrorized by an app that predicts how long you have to live.
The Countdown app, it's really just a random number with a clock. It's not that scary, but it seems like it worked on YouTube clowns.
This must be everyone that downloaded the app.
My sister, she downloaded it.
All we need to do is beat the clock by 1 second.
What if this doesn't work?
A fate much worse than death will pursue you until you are utterly destroyed.
This is your latest installment in that Blumhouse-style, low-budget teen horror movie. It's like a slasher movie, only it's got that supernatural element to it. It's you know, something like Truth or Dare, that kind of a movie. Or what was it, The Gallows, which they're making a sequel of. I will say, first of all, it's great. It's not found footage. It looks like it's going to be okay for just that thrills and chills slumber party horror movie, is what I like to refer to this as. These movies that are horror films, I can appreciate, because I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and throughout the 80s, I saw a lot of these movies either advertised, or I eventually saw them in the theaters, or I saw them on VHS as I got older, because I wasn't old enough to watch R-rated movies until I was at least the mid-80s. But I appreciate the horror movies made for kids. Every generation has them. Every generation has the slasher movies from the 80s. My generation had the slasher movies from the 80s. This generation has these Blumhouse movies that are about these kids, and some of them are terrible. Some of them aren't well done. But I appreciate the thought. And the fact that any horror movie is going to come out in October, I have full respect for, because this is the time for horror movies. It's October, it's Halloween, and I think that having a horror movie come out at this time works. I also like there's a certain supernatural element to this that is moving farther and farther away from that found footage element, and I think that it's playing off of like the Conjuring films and Annabelle and Insidious. This one looks like it's kind of run-of-the-mill. It feels a lot like Truth or Dare, which I didn't particularly like, but I didn't like Truth or Dare more for what they did with the characters in the story at the end. This is yet to be seen for me because I haven't seen it. I might go check it out, and I might look at it when it comes to home cinema. But right now, I'm not even going to give it any sort of preemptive review because they did screen it. It just conflicted with something else I had to check out. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is The Laundromat. Steven Soderbergh directs this whimsical look at the infamous Panama Papers, which uncovered rampant corruption in the business of offshore corporations and investments.
Think of this as a fairy tale that actually happened.
There's confusion over who has to pay.
So they drowned Joe and 20 other innocent people.
And somebody's making money from it.
Oh, it goes back to this law firm, Mossack Fonseca.
So what happens next? What do we do next?
Did was try and send money.
It's a scam that goes from Houston to the West Indies to some bank who knows where.
They're getting away with murder,
which is bad.
Part of the reason I find this one a significant movie, even though it's kind of flown under the radar of a lot of people, first of all, I think the reason it flew under the radar of a lot of people is because, like, it's got like what, like a 40-some% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's like right in the middle. It's like a either or type movie, but nobody's trashing it, nobody's loving it. It's just kind of, Soderbergh has those movies that come out. He's known as a respected director and a well-known director. And of course, you know, he did movies like Traffic, which was winning Academy Awards, and the Ocean's 11 movies, but he's also done movies like Logan Lucky, or even something like Unsane, which came out last year, which I really, really appreciated for the intimate level of a small horror movie that it was, but it wasn't exactly something that charged the mainstream. This is significant because it's the latest in a slate of major directors and major stars who are doing movies for Netflix and not going to the typical theatrical route. Now, The Laundromat did get a qualifying run because it's Soderbergh. Why not at least get it in some theaters? So last week and the week before, it had some runs in the theaters, but now it's on Netflix and anybody can watch it. And it's going to get buried in the next month from The Irishman, which is, that's the one to watch this year. That's the one that I think Netflix is really putting its money behind, putting its weight behind, because it's Martin Scorsese. It's a late film in his career, and he brings back his stable of actors for a gangster movie, and that's something that, that tends to play well with Academy voters. So they're throwing behind that. So I think the Laundromat got kind of lost in the shuffle. But we also saw this last year with the Coen brothers doing The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. You also saw this happen when Sandra Bullock, even though she didn't direct it, she starred in Bird Box, which was a huge phenomenon. And a lot of people watched it. You get these movies that go on Netflix that people are watching. And Netflix is actively changing the way movies are distributed. So let's talk about the Laundromat as a film. Now, it's meant to be whimsical because, you know, it's about financial dealings and corruption, which can be a real slag to get through. It's trying to do what The Big Short did. If you remember that film by Adam McKay, that one was able to at least break down and digest the financial crisis back in 2008. And it did so in a very whimsical way with charts and graphs, but they also had stuff like Margot Robbie in a bathtub explaining to you how certain things worked. And, you know, that spoke to me. Sure. And I remember Adam McKay tried that again last year with Vice when he tried to kind of break down all the complexities of the Iraq invasion and involvement and the business ventures there with Dick Cheney. But he didn't do that as well as he did with The Big Short. In the framing device on this one, you've got Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas as two of the lawyers who run a bunch of these offshore corporations, these shell corporations. And you've got a sort of like the Genesis story with Meryl Streep's character where her husband's killed in an accident and she's just basically trying to recoup insurance money. And she starts pulling on strings and it unravels things. The movie itself is interesting because I don't know anything about the Panama Papers. I don't make enough money to invest in offshore corporations. But this movie does break it down, and it makes it a little easier to understand and digest what's going on, particularly with the wealthy of, you know, millionaires and above. It shows where laws and regulations and international agreements are worked out in such a way to benefit the wealthy, and the wealthy get wealthier. And when you put some oversight on it, it all comes crashing down. But the problem is, this stuff's happening everywhere. And I think that's the point of the movie. And I think the movie makes a good point with that. It seems a little false at times. Like there's a, you know, it gets kicked off with an insurance scam. And I'm like, why would you make an insurance company a shell company? At some point, somebody's going to file a claim and you're going to have to do some real business. The whole point of a shell company is to not do business, just to filter your money through. So there's things like that. And there's like a character who's in charge of like 25,000 companies and she just accidentally dies. And so there's points in that story where it just feels overly manufactured to tell this story. The best parts are Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas and their interstitials explaining how the shell corporations and offshore investments work. It's entertaining and educational, but it does miss its mark about halfway through. Pretty much like almost at the halfway point of the movie, it really starts to stumble and it doesn't have the same pop and power that like The Big Short had, but it's still worth watching. If you have Netflix, check it out. I'm going to say The Laundromat kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Lighthouse and Black and Blue. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. The one that is in limited release and is finally opening wide, it's opening pretty wide this week, so I'm counting it as a full release, is the next one we're going to talk about, which is The Lighthouse. Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson star as two Wiccans who go mad while watching over a remote lighthouse.
What made your last keeper leave?
He believed that there was some enchantment in the light. Went mad, he did.
Tall tales.
What?
Let Neptune strike ye dead, Winslow!
This film is directed by Robert Eggers, who did The Witch. It was a very polarizing movie, came out several years ago. And the reason it was polarizing is because a lot of people said it was intense and scary and creepy, but they forgot to mention that it's not for everybody and it's a very slow burn. It's an art house film at its heart. It's an art house film. And it was A24, and A24 does some very daring releases now. And I love A24 because of that, because A24 doesn't care if it's not something that everybody's going to love. Now, A24 has done some movies that a lot of people have found interest in, but they still do some weird stuff. And I remember, you know, gosh, 5-6 years ago, A24 could have done something like Enemy, which starred Jake Gyllenhaal, or the one with Scarlett Johansson, Under the Skin, or something like that. These were weird art house films that really didn't get a wide release, and that was the appropriate place. But A24 has now expanded. It's a bigger production company and it's a bigger distributor, so they're putting their obscure movies into wide release, and they don't always click with people. And I'm going to tell you, this is not going to click with everybody. The Lighthouse is a bona fide art house movie, 100%. This is not for average people. Do not go see this movie and say, hey, look, it's got Batman and the Green Goblin and the Lighthouse together, let's watch the action happen. You're going to be sorely disappointed. First of all, the movie's in black and white. It was shot on black and white film. It is impossible without the use of colorization techniques to get a color version of this movie. It is a dare to do anything in black and white now, because there's a lot of places that won't release it because they don't believe in black and white movies anymore. It's also shot full frame. Now, if you don't know what full frame is, that's like an old TV. It's square. It's the original Academy frame. You go back to like the original Dracula and Frankenstein, those movies that were made in the 30s, they were all shot with that square frame. And it wasn't until they got widescreen and CinemaScope and all that stuff that you wanted the widescreen thing. So when you go see the movie, it's going to look like the size of a television set. I mean, it's going to be on the screen, but it's going to be square. That's another thing that's a daring release. Nobody does that sort of release. At the very basic, you're on sort of that 1:8:5 aspect ratio that's on a widescreen TV. So it's in full frame, it's in black and white, and most of the dialogue, at least from Willem Dafoe, is this scargy old sea captain. I gotta go down to say, you know, and he's like speaks the slang of the ocean. Eggers did this with The Witch, where he had them speaking in a puritanical tongue, which was contemporary in the 1600s or whatever, but it was very hard to follow. And it's the kind of movie like The Witch that you gotta watch, where it's like watching a Shakespeare play. You have to acclimate yourself to the language of the movie, and eventually you'll catch up to it, but it's fascinating in that way. It's also the best parts about this movie are the cinematography with that stark black and white and the framing design and the sound design in particular. You hear the waves and you hear the foghorn and you hear the siren and you hear the gulls in the background and all the other sea noises. And it really is a fascinating, immersive experience that most people don't care about. I thought it was fascinating. The other thing with this movie is it's all about subtext. I am all for a movie making sense. You have to be able to watch a movie and enjoy it for no subtext whatsoever. Like, great example, I just rewatched with my father, I rewatched Jordan Peele's Us. And that movie works 100% without understanding any of the subtext in it. It just enriches it to understand the subtext and talk about the subtext and talk about what Peele was trying to say about people and families and our society and our country. If you want to dig deeper, you can. Or a great example is Dawn of the Dead. That's just a really cool zombie movie. But there's also a lot of subtext to be said about commercialism and people following a crowd and the inability to release yourself from society. There's a lot of subtext in Dawn of the Dead. As opposed to a movie like Mother from a couple of years ago by Darren Aronofsky, which is almost impossible to watch because you can't make sense of the actual story. It is nothing but subtext because the full, you know, on the surface text really doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And The Lighthouse, it's basically this cute little story about two guys going insane in a lighthouse together. But if you dig into the subtext, there's meaning in there. And not even just in what the characters do and what they say and what they interact with and sort of the visions that they have and the sort of surreal nature to it, that you can interpret things. And it's a challenge to go in there. And it can be anything from very traditional homoerotic elements that are in the movie, and that might be all it is to you. Or it could be something more spiritual, or it could be something that goes back to the gods of the sea. But there is definitely something there, but you can also just look at it as two guys going bonkers in a lighthouse together. Either way, it works. I think any good horror movie should have a certain degree of subtext. Even the original Dracula, maybe not the movie, but the original book, vampirism represented syphilis, which was a big deal back in the late 19th century. And that's the disease that vampirism was based on. And so it had something to be said about society in that day. That's a huge symbol in the vampire lore. Just as, even as stupid as Twilight is, there's a symbol for abstinence in that movie and the books for what vampirism is. So anyways, the whole point is the lighthouse is fascinating. It's brilliantly done. It's captivating. Every year there's some art house movie that I go completely gaga over, even though I tend to turn my nose up at them. This is that movie for me. I was fascinated throughout it, finding visual Easter eggs. And like, there's a scene in there where Willem Dafoe's hair and the way he's standing, his hair looks like waves. It's so clear when you see it, you're like, oh, that looks like the ocean waves. That means something because that was put there deliberately. And that's why I like The Lighthouse so much. So I'm going to have to say The Lighthouse totally rocks, with a caveat knowing it's not for everybody.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about Black and Blue. A police officer finds herself on the run from the cops and criminals alike when she and her body cam witness a crime.
I gotta meet a CI.
Whoa, where are you going?
Stay in the car.
Listen, you already got rid of everyone that could talk.
Whoa.
Just relax.
We're all cops here.
This isn't what it looks like.
She had a body cam on! But we got a ghost! She's gone! Find her!
You got a price on your head. What you gonna do?
I'm gonna expose him.
The big reason I'd want to see this movie is for Naomi Harris. I think I'm a big fan of hers. I've liked her all the way back since, like, what was she in, like, 28 Days Later? I have always been fascinated by her as an actress. I think she's brilliant and beautiful and has a lot of range. I don't think she gets enough work. So it's neat to see her get something that's kind of essentially just an action movie. Maybe she's trying to cut her teeth for a Moneypenny movie. I don't know. But the movie itself does look like what... There's a lot of these corrupt cops fighting with criminals movies. You remember that was that one with Gerard Butler, which was Den of Thieves. And he had, what was it? End of Watch, the one with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, you know, almost, you know, 6-7 years ago. These we see all the time. So I'm not a big fan of these movies. Oh, no, we just had one just recently, that one with David Oyelowo. I don't even remember the name of it. It just felt like we were kind of running the same story again. Only, and even that one had a supernatural element to it. This one just looks like it could be an episode of a TV show. Maybe it's good. I don't know. They didn't screen it, although there is apparently an awards film campaign for it. So I've gotten emails about it. I'm like, that's great. Can I see your movie if you want me to consider it? Idiots. Anyways, they didn't show it to me, so I'm going to have to say that Black and Blue gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Lucy in the Sky, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Lion King. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I've got one more movie review to do, and that is Lucy in the Sky. Natalie Portman stars as an astronaut who loses touch with reality and goes on a crime spree after returning to Earth and starting an affair.
Yep, there it is.
Excuse me?
Major Goodwin has a theory that he can tell who's walked in space just by looking at it.
It is more than a theory.
I need to get back up there.
It's not getting any younger, so you're just gonna have to work harder.
Look at you, straight arrow. You've never done a thing wrong in your life.
I've done plenty of things wrong.
Really?
Dr. Plimpton said you skipped your last three sessions.
I'm giving everything to this program, to the mission.
It kills me to say it, but our girl's been pretty inconsistent recently. Not everyone can handle the ride.
This film has been in limited release for the last several weeks, and it's funny. It was supposed to open in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, this week. But somehow they decided to move it up, and they opened it last week, and I figured, well, I'll keep it on the docket, and I'll talk about it, because it's a movie that's getting a certain degree of buzz, and it stars Natalie Portman, and of course she's an Oscar winner who's always showing up in Oscar nominations, and you know, she's a significant player. And I remember when I was talking about this, when Ad Astra came out, I knew people got that confused. We've had a lot of astronaut movies recently. Now, of course, First Man was last year, and we have the Apollo 11 documentary that came out earlier this year, a lot of it because of the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. Plus, we, of course, had Ad Astra, and now we've got Lucy in the Sky. There's a lot of movies about astronauts, and that's great, because I love the space program, and I love the space race. It's interesting with Lucy in the Sky, because that's a more contemporary story, but it really doesn't have anything to do with space. It just has to do with astronauts. But it's made a little bit of buzz, and I figured it was worth talking about because even though it's not releasing this week, it's still out there. And it's, like I said in the blurb, it's a movie about this woman who spacewalks, and she goes out, and she's a successful astronaut. When she returns to Earth, she starts to have a little bit of a breakdown. Now, it's based on a real-life woman, but it's not a direct one-to-one thing. It's not a story about her, but it's inspired by her story. And there was a real astronaut who, when she got back, she started to have some sort of personal issues, had an affair, and then tried to kidnap somebody involved in the affair. I don't want to give too much away, but it made news. And it's funny because I had another radio show host say to me, he goes, oh, is that the one with the diapers? Because apparently one of the things is she drives from, you know, like Houston to Los Angeles or something like that. This 18-hour drive, and just used adult diapers so she didn't have to stop. And I'm like, that's what they're known about. This entire story about this woman who has a psychological break and has all these horrible things happen in her life, and her marriage is collapsing and she's having these affairs, and it's reduced to, oh, it's the movie about the diapers. It's not about diapers. It's just that happens to be in there. Although I wish it was about diapers, because it would have been a lot more interesting. The movie itself is well made, but pretentious. And I mentioned when I talked about The Lighthouse how it's shot in an Academy full frame. This movie, now it's the director's first film. He's done a lot of writing, but it's his first film. But he does widescreen, he does CinemaScope, he keeps changing the aspect ratio. And he does it in relation to what the characters are feeling. And I'm sorry, that's just annoying. It's one thing to play with aspect ratio when necessary, like when you're doing an IMAX movie and you have only so many shots in IMAX, and IMAX is almost a vertical frame. Even LIMAX is that vertical frame. And you saw that if you ever saw The Dark Knight, the aspect ratio kept changing throughout the movie. But in this one, it does it based on what people are feeling. And it's, you notice it. That's the problem, is you notice it. And if you notice that sort of thing, that's what makes it a problem. As opposed to something like the movie Brother Bear, which is, I know, almost 20 years old, but it's from the point of view of a human, and that's full frame. And then when the human wakes up as a bear, it's widescreen. I didn't even notice that until it came on video. And I think that was a neat way of doing it, because it wasn't terribly noticeable. It was sort of like when Dorothy's house lands in Oz and it goes from black and white or sepia tone to color. But in Lucy in the Sky, it's so heavy handed, and it tries to get overly artistic at times, when it really is just about a woman sort of losing her mind because she has some mental issues. But it also, it's the ultimate in privilege, where you're like, oh, I've been to space and I've looked at the immensity of the universe and now I can't handle it. And you're like, wham-boo-hoo, the one of 20-some people who've ever done that in the history of time. Who cares? I mean, talk about some real problems. And the reality is that's also a fallacy. It's the people don't go to space and lose their mind because of the immensity of it. This is not some crappy 1950s movie that they're trying to spin off an Isaac Asimov story. This is real life. And if you go to space. That gives you a greater understanding, but you're still a human being and a scientist. You should be able to take it. Anyways, Lucy in the Sky, it was so boring. I was in the back of the theater. I'm texting my wife and I said, she's like, what's it about? And I told her and she's like, well, what character are you rooting for? And I go, well, I'm rooting for space right now, but unfortunately space only shows up in the first scene or two, and then the rest of it's about this idiot woman. So I did not like Lucy in the Sky. It totally sucks. I understand why they're just kind of dumping it out there and not completely running the full rock and roll release from town to town, trying to keep it alive during award season. Lucy in the Sky totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, Maleficent did not do as well as people had hoped. It didn't come near what the first movie did, but it came in considerably less from what people were predicting. It was kind of a flop. I mean, it made less than $40 million, and people were predicting upwards of $50 million for the weekend. And with numbers like that, it's just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. The other thing that's interesting about it is while it had a great CinemaScore only rates what people who want to see the movie thought. So I think what that shows is that with the low number, not a whole lot of people wanted to see the movie, but of those who wanted to see it, they liked it. Joker is holding incredibly well, just made under $30 million, finally got knocked to number two. Zombieland Double Tap did okay, just under $27 million. Not bad for the sequel that nobody wanted and 10 years old. This week, it's going to be tough to predict exactly what's going to win. Will Countdown or Black and Blue have enough money to beat Joker again? Who knows? Joker may win this weekend. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Disney's The Lion King. Jon Favreau directs this photorealistic CGI adaptation of Disney's animated classic film about a lion cub who must take his rightful place as king of the jungle.
Everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. While others search for what they can take, a true king searches for what he can give. You must take your place in the circle of life.
The Lion King was a very weirdly and unnecessarily polarizing movie. There were people who just hated on this movie. And I gotta say, I thought it was charming. I will admit, it's almost purely a shot-for-shot remake. And yeah, the faces aren't terribly expressive because they're animal faces, but I think that's what makes the movie work. It reminds me a lot of Jungle Book, although at least his version of the Jungle Book differed significantly from the original animated classic. And in a lot of ways, the voice cast is just as good, even the ones that they replace. I mean, James Earl Jones comes back as Mustafa, but the new characters and the new voices, I think, totally work. And it's a neat experiment, and it's a neat way to readapt a movie. I would have rather seen this than have them greatly change the story. That you would have ended up with something like Dumbo, which just didn't quite work. And no, this is not a live-action version. It's a photorealistic CGI version. It's animated. There's not a real pixel in this. There's not a real frame of any. There are no real animals that they shot for this movie. But it sure looks like it, and that's what's beautiful about this. And I think it's a nice alternative take on The Lion King. But yeah, this one absolutely works. And it's a neat little movie. It's the only major theatrical release that's new this week. So that's your option. But I think it's for kids and Disney fans. It has this nice mix between the original animated story and the history that Disney has with nature films. Now, the Blu-ray has some bonus features that are decent. It has about an hour-long documentary that goes back and forth about what they did for the film. And there's more information about the music and some music videos, and you can do the song selection. A lot of it does focus on the music. It's not loaded with special features, but it's enough that it gives you something more than just the streaming version, which is why it's always kind of nice to get the physical copy. But, of course, you also get, with the Blu-ray-DVD combo, you get the streaming version as well, with a digital code. So I'm going to still say that The Lion King new version totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Other releases this week include Nosferatu Season 1, The Veronica Mars Revival, Season 1, and Parasite 3D, the original one with Demi Moore. That is it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Terminator, Dark Fate, and Jojo Rabbit. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.